evolution, making converts to evolution, methodological naturalism as a rhetorical weapon in The Origin of Species.
Methodological naturalism, which I'll refer to as MN throughout the talk, is widely accepted in contemporary science. And by methodological naturalism, I mean not just the commitment to account for natural phenomena by naturalistic or secondary explanations, but also the prohibition of explicitly supernatural explanations within science. Because of the importance and prevalence of MN, a closer look at its history is in order, especially as it relates to the work of Charles Darwin, whose work is often cited as a prime justification for MN. His work is often cited in conjunction or as epitomizing, embodying MN in some way. Surprisingly, little attention has been given to Darwin's strategic deployment of MN in The Origin. A close inspection, I will argue, shows that Darwin did not use MN statically in the six editions of The Origin. Instead, I contend that he strategically and progressively invoked MN over the six editions of The Origin in order to maximize the effectiveness of his one long argument. That is, Darwin shrewdly deployed MN in order to enhance the persuasiveness of his theory and to marginalize special creation from the scientific discussion. In particular, Darwin's explicit use of MN in later editions of The Origin was animated less by epistemic reasons, those intellectual arguments for the justification of MN, less animated by that kind of thing, and instead more by rhetorical reasons, that is, expedient reasons designed to persuade others about his theory. Thus, I'll contend that while Darwin may have personally had sound epistemic reasons for MN, his progressive deployment of the method in The Origin seems to have been mainly for the purpose of winning converts to his theory and ostracizing special creation, rather than making a strong empirical and philosophical case per se for his view. So let me talk briefly about Darwin's commitment to MN in his early years and in the origin. Contemporary scholarship has established that Darwin held a firm commitment to activity as a properly scientific explanation for natural phenomena long before he penned The Origin. In the first three editions, in 59, 60, and 61, all in close succession, Darwin routinely claimed that the ordinary view of creation only restates the fact in dignified language, adds nothing to our knowledge, is a cloak for ignorance, fails to provide a rational explanation, or simply gives no explanation at all. More than a dozen times, Darwin claimed that key data are inexplicable on the theory of creation. He also repeatedly stated that miracles violated the famed vera causa requirement for proper scientific explanations. Yet, despite this strong language, and despite his adherence to MN for two decades prior to The Origin, Darwin did not explicitly invoke MN in the first three editions. His language gestured towards MN, but he stopped short of explicitly saying that special creation is not a scientific explanation. That doesn't appear in the first three editions. All right? What about the shift here? There's a shift. The explicit use of MN appears only in the later three editions. Explicit MN appears once in the fourth edition, that's in 1866. That's repeated in the fifth, in 69. That's repeated in the sixth edition, in 72, along with three other explicit invocations of MN. Of course, there are other subtle changes in these later editions that indirectly emphasize Darwin's commitment to MN, but these four changes are the only direct and explicit ones. In the fourth edition, during Darwin's argument about homology, in which he says the similarity of pattern in members of the same class is not a scientific explanation, end quote. In previous versions, previous editions of this passage, he had expressed dismay at appealing to the Creator's pleasure or will, but did not explicitly say that doing so did not qualify as scientific. Moreover, an examination of the context of this passage in the fourth edition shows that Darwin did not support his appeal, his explicit appeal to MN, with new evidence or arguments. Three more instances of MN surface in the sixth and final edition of The Origin. For time's sake, I'll just mention one. You can all rest assured that the others conform to my thesis. In Darwin's discussion of the utilitarian doctrine, which held that every detail of structure is produced for the good of its possessor, in his discussion of that doctrine, he stated that an explanation that appealed to the delight of the Creator is beyond, this is his language, is beyond the scope of scientific discussion, end quote. In previous editions in this passage, he had not explicitly mentioned a Creator, much less said that such appeals were outside of science. In this case, and in fact in every case of his explicit employment of MN, Darwin did not tie his new empirical evidence for evolution and against special creation to his explicit appeals to MN. These overt appeals were either just tacked on to passages that were largely unchanged from previous editions, or they appeared in new passages that didn't introduce any significant new evidence relevant to the use of MN in those passages. More importantly, in addition to not giving empirical arguments for MN, Darwin did not provide additional philosophical reasons, which are the really important reasons, for MN in these later editions either. Instead, he simply reiterated the reasons or gestures he had given in the first three editions. Thus, even if Darwin's overt use of MN in later editions was epistemically justified by his reasons or gestures in early editions, the explanation for why he changed from tacit to explicit MN does not appear to be epistemic. It's the same reasons. What changes is the display of MN. The intellectual basis for MN was essentially unchanged throughout all editions. All that changed was Darwin's presentation of it. No new reasons, just new rhetoric. So why is that? Well, the answer to the question is complicated, but it's my view that Darwin deployed MN explicitly in later editions as a rhetorical tool to help advance descent with modification while also undermining special creation. To see this more clearly, consider the immediate intellectual context just prior to 1859. Painting with very broad brushstrokes, there were two main features of the pre-origin era of British and American science. The first was the prominence of natural theology and science. Even if special creation was waning by Darwin's time, few were willing to let go of the divine hand in biology to the extent that Darwin was. In fact, if you read his correspondence closely between late 1859 and early 1861, which is the crucial period spanning the first three editions, it shows that he anticipated and experienced great opposition to his theory, in part because his theory minimized God's role in natural history. The second crucial feature of the pre-origin era was the rise of MN itself. As a number of historians have shown, there was a growing interest among scientists in moving away from appeals to God's direct activity and toward appeals to secondary causes, including the laws of nature. So it's in this atmosphere that Darwin penned his famous work. On the one side, he confronted the natural theological tradition, which had, at its extreme end, special creation's panoply of miracles. And on the other side, there was the deep and growing sentiment that proper explanations in science must not refer to miracles or the divine, but instead explained by natural law or secondary causes. So while the tide was moving in the direction of the latter, advocates of special creation and more generally natural theology still held some influence over some key areas of science. At least Darwin thought so. Think of Darwin's relationship with Sedgwick or his awareness of Agassiz. Agassiz was nearing the height of his fame at that time in the U.S. Darwin was also aware, by the way, of the very negative responses among scientists whom he respected to the evolutionary ideas and vestiges of creation. So he was cautious. Given this context, it was crucial for Darwin in the first edition of The Origin to acknowledge that special creation was a formidable rival that was accepted by prominent thinkers, as he did several times in the early editions of The Origin. He wrote in the introduction, for example, that, quote, most naturalists believe that each species has been independently created. And in the finale of the book, he noted, quote, authors of the highest eminence seem to be fully satisfied with the view that each species has been independently created, end quote. Darwin may have believed, or at least thought many of his colleagues believed, that special creation was prominent, and so as a result, he may well have realized that explicitly invoking MN would have been a tactical error, possibly hampering his efforts to promote his own view. Michael Ruse has noted that Darwin feared offending the leaders of his scientific set, which included those who controlled science. Darwin perhaps thought that he could not simply pronounce that special creation was unscientific when there were well-established advocates of that view already within science. When one attacks the enemy's fortress, one should not expect the enemy to have already surrendered. Darwin, of course, did strongly argue that special creation was false. It's another thing to say it's not even false, and he was hesitant to do so in the first editions. Okay, now for our second major question. Why did Darwin become overt about MN when his justification for the method was no different than in early editions? Why in later editions was he more explicit, yet had no new arguments for it? The answer to this question is complicated and involved, but part of it, I think, is that Darwin realized by the mid-1860s that the tide was turning in his direction, and by the early to mid-1870s, evolution, at least common ancestry, had become the received view. He used this shift to aid the final stage of his campaign against special creation. The conditions were now ripe to pronounce explicitly that special creation was entirely outside the realm of science. Evidence for this claim comes from a variety of sources. First, by way of general support, a number of historians have shown that the mid-1860s to early 70s was the crucial time in which the scientific establishment accepted common ancestry. Second, by the close of the 1860s, Darwin believed, you can see this from his personal correspondence, he believed that the most prominent special creationists who attacked the origin, think Sedgwick, Agassiz, or Hopkins, had lost their influence. Sedgwick didn't explicitly inveigh against evolution or promote special creation by the late 1860s. Darwin was convinced that Agassiz had lost his influence among the younger good naturalists by that time. And Hopkins, by 1867, rather, was dead. So he said very little in favor of special creation. Third, Darwin knew that friendlies and even opponents recognized the ascendancy of evolution by the late 1860s in their public reviews, their published reviews and pronouncements. For example, critic Fleming Jenkin observed in 1867 that Darwin's theory, quote, has been received as probable and even as certainly true by many who are competent to form an intelligent opinion, end quote. Fourth, Darwin also knew that Baden Powell, Henry Fawcett, George Mivart, and others claimed that evolutionary theory was actually theologically superior to special creation. By 1871, for example, Chauncey Wright could confidently boast that orthodoxy has been won over to the doctrine of evolution. Fifth, Darwin's private correspondence from 1862 to 72, which is really interesting to read, also displays his awareness of the migration towards evolution. For example, when he won the prestigious Copley Award in 1864, he wrote privately, quote, "It shows, however, that natural selection is making some progress in this country, and that pleases me. The subject, however, is safe in foreign lands," end quote. In general, between 1862 and 72, he progressively wrote less about opposition and more about converts, that's his word, to evolution, including converts in Germany, France, and America. Finally, as a sixth line of evidence, the origin itself clearly reveals Darwin's awareness of the shift. Of the many passages, for example, in the final chapter, in the first edition, the very first edition, Darwin wrote, quote, "Why, it may be asked, have all the most eminent living naturalists and geologists rejected this view of the mutability of species?" You can look at this passage, and over subsequent editions, Darwin alters it, so that by the time of the sixth edition, the passage, that same sentence had become, quote, "Why, it may be asked, until recently did nearly all the most living eminent naturalists and geologists disbelieve this view of the mutability of species," unquote. This time frame from the early 60s to the early 70s was precisely the same time that Darwin began to introduce explicit references to MN in The Origin. Recall that Darwin's first overt use of MN came in the fourth edition in 66. This use of MN was retained in the fifth in 69 and resurfaced in the sixth edition, 72, along with three other explicit references. In fact, in a new paragraph introduced in the sixth edition, in which Darwin states that special creation had been abandoned, but, quote, "now almost every naturalist admits the great principle of evolution," end quote, in that same paragraph, he goes on to invoke MN, declaring, quote, "under a scientific view, little advantage is gained by believing in the creation of species from the dust of the earth," end quote. Darwin pronounced evolution's victory in the same breath as he appealed to methodological naturalism. Now that evolution was the received view, he was free to state that its one-time rival had not just been defeated, but had never been a rival at all. It's one thing to meet your opposition in head-to-head battle and come out the victor. It's quite another to declare that you have no enemies at all. That's what he did in the later editions. In sum, all of Darwin's explicit invocations of MN arise exactly during the period in which he began to acknowledge in private letters and in The Origin itself that the scientific community was warming to evolution. Not coincidentally, this timeline matches what contemporary historians have established for the transition. Moreover, by the third edition, Darwin had already given his full epistemic reasons for MN. So there is not any more epistemic reason to invoke MN overtly in later editions than in early editions. Instead, the most salient reason for the explicit use of MN seems to be sociological. Darwin realized that the consensus was turning towards evolution, and so adjusted his language in later editions to reflect and to drive home the demise of special creation. In Darwin's mind, prior to The Origin in 1859, special creation had been a waning, yet sociologically formidable adversary. With the early editions of The Origin, vocal support for special creation had weakened, and by the final edition, it was time to declare special creation was a charade. The sociological shift allowed him greater freedom to say what he had already believed, but what, in a previous time, his cautious nature and prudential reasoning had muted. By the mid-1860s, Darwin saw, in the changing spirit of the times, a rhetorical opportunity to complete his quest to naturalize organic history. Although I don't have time to go into it much, I will note that additional evidence for my thesis can be found by examining Darwin's book on orchids in 62, Variation Under Domestication in 68, and Descent of Man in 71. As my thesis predicts, Darwin did not explicitly cite MN in The Orchids, published before the turn to evolution, but he did do so both in Variation and Descent, published when the tide had turned or was turning towards evolution. And I've also noted here, if you read Variation to Dissent carefully, you'll notice that there are no new epistemic reasons for MN in those books that did not already appear in the early editions of the Origin. Okay, so just to summarize, I have argued first that Darwin strategically deployed MN in the editions of the Origin in a manner sensitive to the changing spirit of the times so as to maximize the persuasiveness of his argument for dissent with modification and against special creation. Second, Darwin's explicit use of MN in later editions of the Origin was largely expedient or rhetorical in nature rather than epistemic, enabling to advance his own theory by progressively marginalizing special creation from the scientific discussion. Thank you. My sense is that the piety of Darwin's wife probably was irrelevant to Darwin's deployment of methodological naturalism. And that's because, even from the very first editions of The Origin, he's already making a pretty robust argument that special creationism is false, right? It's a really subsidiary claim, once you've said it's false, to say, by the way, it's scientific. It's not scientific, rather. So my sense is, because he was making this kind of, he felt comfortable enough, right, making this very frontal argument about God's providential design, discrete design in history, in organic history, that if he was comfortable enough to do that, given his wife's piety, then I doubt if his wife's piety would very much influence his use of a demarcation argument. That would be my sense. That's a good question. He adds that twice, reference to the Creator. In a later edition, one of those references is taken out, but the other is continued even through the later editions. More broadly, I think I've done some study on Darwin's use of theology, and I think he actually uses theology substantively in his arguments, not just rhetorically, but as epistemic substance in his arguments, including his famous arguments, like his homology argument. So it does look like there's a bit of a tension there, and I think the answer to your question is he's not consistent. I think Darwin is interested in invoking theology at an epistemic level when it helps his case for dissent with modification, but then when he encounters theology he doesn't like, appeal to a creator's delight or pleasure, then he slaps this label that it's not scientific. So I think he's probably just inconsistent. Any other questions? I could keep rambling on, but you might want to stop me. Yeah, Larry. Yeah, it's really interesting to read his correspondence. The guy is... This isn't my word. This is what other thinkers who've studied his correspondence say. The guy was obsessive. I mean, he just monitored the reception of his theory very, very, very carefully. Not just the Origin, but like Orchids. He was just wailing and gnashing his teeth for a little while and wondering if it was he ever should have written the book and how people would respond. So I think by looking at his correspondence, you can see. He's very, very much aware. You know, he has people like Huxley writing to him and saying, look, so-and-so, a lot of these reviews were published anonymously, so Darwin and his colleagues are zipping letters back and forth. Who did this? Darwin recruits people to respond to letters. Huxley feels free, and some others do. But very, very close monitoring. Yeah, it's really quite interesting. It makes sense, right? He'd been developing the theory for 20 years. This is how he's going to be known, and he wanted to make sure his His baby survived and thrived. Help me with the question a little bit. I didn't quite catch it. Yeah. Right. Right. Yeah, that's right. In fact, if you read his private correspondence with Asa Gray about his book on orchids, published in 62, he says to Gray, you're one of the few that have perceived that this is a flank maneuver, that's his phrase, on the enemy. At the same time, if you go back and read his private correspondence, at the same time he was writing the book on orchids, he wrote a letter to a colleague in which he said, look, if we allow for providentially arranged variations, that makes natural selection superfluous and takes the whole case out of the realm of science. So he clearly endorsed MN, fully believed it at the time he was writing the orchids. So why didn't he say so, right? He's completely overt about this. It's because the orchids was designed, in his words, as a flank movement. I think he perceived by reading these reviews that the time just wasn't ripe to say, look, you guys don't even count. You shouldn't even be in the discussion. It's hard to do that when you have folks like Sedgwick at Cambridge who's publishing, and Agassiz who's, as I mentioned before, very, very popular, very, very prominent. So I think there's a number of lines of evidence here, but I think it was largely sociologically driven. Okay, great, thank you.